The original point of the book for me was actually to write a non-fiction work. I wanted to write a history of the New York Stock Exchange. And that, frankly, just got a little dull because it was, you know, it was difficult to get any texture into that, any sort of color into it. So I deviated into writing this murder mystery, which kind of took over the project.
That's Patty Hirsch, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. You may know Patty Hirsch from his work as a journalist for NPR and Marketplace. He previously authored Man vs. Markets, a nonfiction book explaining economics. He joins us next to talk about his debut work of fiction, The Devil's Half Mile, which is set in New York in 1799. Patty, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed.
Give us an overview of this novel. What are readers going to find here?
So this is a work of historical fiction where it's 1799, we're in New York. It's called The Devil's Half Mile, which was a nickname for Wall Street. This is Alexander Hamilton's Wall Street. And we have a young Irish-American lawyer who has returned to New York after several years at university and a little period of time with the Paris police to find out who murdered his father and why. And when he comes across, he finds that although he's looking at solving a cold case because his father was murdered 8 years before, he actually finds there's a killer at work in the streets of New York City at the time. So he's got several things going on. He's juggling these murders that are happening, and he's sort of lending his experience there. He's also trying to solve his father's murder. But also he finds himself getting sucked into a financial scandal, and he's got to be very, very careful because if he makes a wrong step, he could trigger a financial crisis that could actually collapse the nascent economy of the United States.
Patty, I want to talk a little bit about inspiration for the story. You yourself are Irish. How did your heritage play into wanting to tell this story?
Well, I was very interested in the Irish immigrant experience. You know, the Irish were brutally oppressed at this point in time. I mean, there have been a couple of hundred years of oppression underneath the boot heel of the British, of the English. And, you know, I thought about what the Irish must have thought back then in 1799. You know, they must have looked across the Atlantic and saw this country that had thrown off the yoke of British oppression and gone it alone. And they must have thought, wow, this is the place to go. You know, we can leave this country of Ireland, which is so, you know, brutally oppressed, go across to America, and we can be free. And I think they came to the United States, and New York in particular, and they had a very nasty surprise, because New York, to all intents and purposes, was an English city. Yes, of course, they got rid of the king, and they got rid of the king's laws, and they got rid of the king's army, but still, it had been an English city for a very long time. The population was pretty much English. And so that population retained all of its prejudices. And the Irish arrived in New York thinking that they were coming to this, you know, land of milk and honey, perhaps, but find that they'd really just exchanged one oppression for another. As Irish, they were regarded as subhuman. You know, they were depicted in illustrations of the time as apes, you know, with sort of very apish Neanderthal features. They were regarded as subhuman and you know, not fit for any kind of intellectual work. They were barred from universities and from higher education. I mean, some of this might sound a little familiar with a parallel with today. So, you know, I really wanted to kind of tell that story. The other part of it was that, you know, I was brought up in the Protestant tradition, which means that I learned about the British conquest and occupation of Ireland, but it was a kind of a sanitized history. And it wasn't until I started to do real research that I realized just how horrendous that oppression had been. And I've spent time in Bosnia, Herzegovina, and I know what ethnic cleansing means. And to an extent, there was some ethnic cleansing going on in Ireland. It was a horrific time. And when I say time, I'm talking about several hundred years. And that made a very deep impression upon me, because I kind of felt cheated by my education. And I was actually really, really surprised by what I learned. And I wanted to tell that story in some small way. So I've tried to do that in this book.
Has your training as a journalist helped you as an author of fiction?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as a journalist, you know, you want to be as accurate as possible, you know, when you're telling a story. You want to get as much texture into a story as possible, you know, so you find yourself doing a great deal of research, rightly so, otherwise you're not going to get the full picture. And I find that as I was writing fiction, I really kind of did the same thing. I mean, I used the same skills, the same research skills that I've used as a journalist, because I really wanted to have this frame of history, this frame of this factual frame around the narrative. And I wanted it to be as accurate as possible and meticulously accurate if I could. So I did a great deal of research, and I've tried to paint this picture where the texture around the actual story, of course, many of the characters are fictional. There are some non-fictional characters in there as well. And of course, the storyline is fictional. But the frame around it, in terms of what the city looked like, what it smelled like, what was going on at the time, all of that is as factually accurate as I can make it. And, you know, journalism came into that.
Well, obviously, you'd worked for Marketplace as well, so you had a chance to look at today's economy. Was that part of what inspired this story, that you want to do something historic, but you're also doing something that talks about the economy?
Absolutely. I mean, I was struck by the fact, actually, whilst I was researching, how many similarities there are between now and then. Back in 1799, the country was just recovering from America's first financial crisis. They had a large financial collapse in 1792, when there was a speculator called William Duer, who was speculating wildly with bank stocks and government bonds. And because he borrowed too much and was unable to pay off his debts, it triggered a financial collapse. And Alexander Hamilton had to step in and bail out the banks. I don't know if any of that sounds familiar to you. You know, here we are, 10 years on from the 2008 financial crisis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was struck by those parallels. The original point of the book for me was actually to write a nonfiction work. I wanted to write a history of the New York Stock Exchange. And that, frankly, just got a little dull because it was difficult to get any texture into that, any sort of color into it. So I deviated into writing this murder mystery, which kind of took over the project. But whilst I was doing that, I thought, well, what is it that I want to do whilst I'm telling this story? And what I wanted to do was kind of talk about a couple of things. Firstly, the need for rules and regulations around a financial market. Secondly, the debate that went on then, which we're hearing again now, this push and pull between should we have lots and lots of rules for people, or should we allow people to self-regulate, which I think is something we're hearing right now when we talk about the rollback of Dodd-Frank and financial regulation. And thirdly, there was this thing that I keep hearing again and again and again when I speak to people about the financial crisis, the 2008 financial crisis. It's, why didn't anybody go to jail? And, you know, sometimes storytelling can actually give us a much more clear, that is to say, fictional storytelling can give us a much more clear through line to a preferred solution, which is that, you know, bad people should go to jail for doing bad things and, you know, they should be punished. But obviously, in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, it's been very difficult to see that happen because the situation is so complex. So in a way, I wanted to tell a story that was very, very clean in terms of its morality. Mm-hmm. And that's a reason why the fiction really kind of, you know, lent itself to that.
So, in fact, you do point out in the book that Duer did go to jail, a very nice jail for the time, but yet he was incarcerated.
He was. Back then, it's interesting because we've got many, many rules right now and nobody goes to jail. Back then, they had no rules at all. But the one rule that they did have was that if you couldn't pay your debts, you went to debtor's prison. And yes, William Duer did go to debtor's prison, which was actually located right around where City Hall Park is in New York today. And you're right, it was a very sumptuous prison, depending on which level you were in, apparently. There were sort of three or four floors. And depending on which floor you were on, you got a certain standard of service or a certain standard of treatment, because the cellar apparently was very bleak and horrible, but the top floor was actually rather nice.
Yeah, you talk about he had his own private library, and wow, he had his own privy.
He had his own privy, exactly, yes.
So I want to talk a bit more about the research, because you needed to make the story ring true for the time, and it wasn't just history or location, but how the language has changed. So it seems like that must have been an interesting and challenging bit of research for you to make sure, as these characters talk, that it makes sense for the time period, but also you write it in such a way that you can kind of explain those odd phrases to the readers as you go along.
Yeah, so it was tricky because, you know, when you read letters of the time, they're written in this very kind of archaic style. And, you know, I didn't want to replicate that because then the book would be unreadable. And, you know, people who've written historical fiction from about this time have done that. They've written in exactly the style that people would have communicated with each other. And it's this very sort of, it sounds very highfalutin now, and it's actually pretty impenetrable, in my opinion. So I wanted to make the conversations between characters as plain as possible. But at the same time, there are certain flourishes of language that I wanted to put in there. And certainly when it comes to slang, you know, there was a lot of great slang that they used back then, some of which actually has been incorporated into our language today. But I wanted to use as much of this slang as I possibly could without making it impenetrable. So it's this delicate balance of putting that slang in there and putting that language in there without sort of overwhelming the reader. Now, I should say that there is a glossary in this book, actually. If it's at the back of the book, you can actually look words up if you're like, oh, I can't understand what the heck's going on here. So you can actually go to the back and look it up. But for the most part, I've tried to sort of, you know, I'll use the slang in one sentence and then the next sentence I'll sort of spell out what it actually means or try to do that. So it's a delicate act, but I'm glad to hear it was successful.
Patty, there is a question that I like to ask authors of fiction, and it is this. If you could spend a day with one of the characters in your book, who would it be and why?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. So I think my favorite character, he's not my favorite character, but one of my favorite characters, the guy I'd like to spend the day with is this character called the Bull, Ignatius Flanagan. He's Justy's uncle. And while Justy's father had, when he came across from Ireland, had decided to take the high road and become, or try to become a stockbroker on Wall Street, Justy's uncle, Ignatius, decides to take the low road and becomes basically a gang leader on the waterfront of New York. And he's this particular, he's a big lad, he's, you know, broad, he's built like an ox, hence the Bull, and he's a hard man with a very violent past. But he's got a softness to him in some ways as well. But it's that world of the waterfront, I think, really fascinates me. You know, when you had the Irish coming across in large numbers, not as large as in the 1840s, but still fairly significant numbers, they arrived. Very few of them had skills because they were so oppressed back in Ireland. They didn't have the access to education. They couldn't get educated in the United States because, you know, they weren't Protestant. They were Catholic for the most part, and you couldn't get a place at university. It was very difficult to get schooled if you were Irish Catholic. So they were laborers and they were criminals in many ways, although there weren't that many rules back then, but they were involved in, you know, prostitution. They did a lot of thieving. There was a lot of kind of waterfront work. They were stevedores and dock workers, and the women were working in the big houses in New York as in restaurants as waitresses, in the houses as laundry maids and all this kind of stuff. So this world of the sort of the lower working class and the underworld in many ways is something that I was really, really fascinated by. So I think the Bull would be my choice of companion for a day.
I want to talk a bit more about a couple of your other characters. Obviously, Justy, the main character, he was interesting because he left New York and he studied law, but he also studied a bit about a new science that was kind of coming along, and that was sort of forensic science and looking at crime scenes.
Yeah, so criminology is this very interesting science that really only got any attention, I think, starting right around, you know, the late 1700s, so around 1800. And it was really only in France that this was happening because nobody else really had a police force. The French had actually had some kind of a gendarmerie or a police force in Paris in particular since the early 1700s, possibly even the late 1600s. It's quite hard to tell. The French were, you know, had police, and police were investigating crime for quite some time. And the British didn't catch on to this until very late in the 17th century. So Justy has gone to Paris as part of his, you know, he's been at university in Ireland. He's been studying law. And of course, as you know, when you're studying law, when you're studying jurisprudence, maybe you want to get an idea of what criminals do and how, you know, criminals interact with the law. So he goes to Paris for a little bit of special training, and he works with the police force in Paris, learning some of the techniques of detection that they were working on. The first detectives actually existed in Paris. Then the British took that up, and then we saw it in America. So he is very much on the cutting edge of criminology, and it's really as a result of his visit to Paris and his spending some time with the gendarme there.
The other character I wanted you to tell our listeners a bit more about is Carrie.
Yes, Carrie is a very interesting character because she and Justy grew up together. She's sort of 4 or 5 years younger than Justy. And whenever Justy left New York to go to university, Carrie was still a child. But now he's returned 4 years later, and Carrie is now a grown woman, as you know, it happens whenever, you know, you know, that period between, you know, the teens and your 20s, suddenly he comes back and she's a different person, and the relationship is radically different. And Kerry is, she's a mixed race daughter of an escaped slave and an Irish gangster. Her father is actually the sidekick of the Bull, who I mentioned earlier. And, you know, because she's stuck between these two worlds, she has to find her way. And because she's a very independent thinker, she doesn't want to sort of knuckle under and, you know, do what is expected of her, which would be, you know, basically become a scullery maid or something. Because as someone of mixed race, it would be very difficult to make your way in either society. And so she decides to go her own way. I won't give too much away, but she's a fascinating character for all sorts of reasons. In many ways, there are a lot of parallels with women today and the challenges that women face today. And I think that you know, her relationship with Justy is complicated, which makes the story much more interesting.
Now that you've written your first work of fiction, are you planning to write more? Is this a genre that you're enjoying?
I'm enjoying it very much, much more than I expected to. When I started this, I thought, well, I might do this as a one-off and then try something else. But I got so into it, and I love these characters so much, and I feel that they've got so much depth to them, and there are so many opportunities that I think I'm going to turn it into a series. And at the very least, there will be one more. Macmillan actually bought two books, so the second one is being edited right now. So I'm hoping that in a year, we'll see the sequel coming out. The working title of that is Hudson's Kill. So hopefully we'll see that pretty soon. And if audiences like it, if readers like it, then, you know, we'll think about producing some more. Certainly I've got a lot of ideas in my head, a lot of stories that I could throw on the page. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Patty, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Dan, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Patty Hirsch's novel is The Devil's Half Mile. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. On Facebook, you'll find us at KPR Conversations. That's all one word. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. And you can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.